One could lace up the door with padlocks and binding spells. Bach, do you take me for a fool? No, I don't take you for a fool. So tell me what you found, he said. His findings are well hidden away, she said, and though there are colossal holes in my training, I am studying it on my own. You mean you're not going to show me? He was shocked. It was never your particular interest, she said. Besides, until there's something to prove, what's the point? I don't think Dr. Dillamond was there yet. I am a Munchkinlander, he answered proudly. Look, Elfie, you've more or less convinced me what the wizard is up to. The confining of animals back onto farms to give the dissatisfied Munchkinlander farmers the impression he's doing something for them, and also to provide forced labor for the sinking of useless new wells. It's vile. But this affects Wend Hardings and the towns that sent me here. I have a right to know what you know. Maybe we can figure it out together, work to make a change. You have too much to lose, she said. I'm going to take this on myself. Take what on? She only shook her head. The less you know, the better, and I mean for your sake. Whoever killed Dr. Dillamond doesn't want his findings made public. What kind of a friend would I be to you if I put you at risk, too? What kind of friend would I be to you if I didn't insist? He retorted. But she wouldn't tell him. When he sat next to her during the rest of the class and passed her little notes, she ignored them all. Later he thought that they might have developed a genuine impasse in their friendship, had the odd attack on the newcomer not occurred during that very session. Dr. Nikodik had been lecturing on the life force, and twining around each wrist the two separate tendrils of his long, straggly beard, he spoke in falling tones so that only the first half of each sentence made it to the back of the room. Hardly a single student was following. When Dr. Nikodik took a small bottle from his vest pocket and mumbled something about extract of biological intention, only the students in the front row sat up and opened their eyes. For Bach and Elphaba and everyone else, the patter ran, "A little sauce for the soup, mumble, mumble. As if creation were an unconcluded mumble, mumble, mumble. Notwithstanding the obligations of all sentient mumble, mumble, mumble. And so as a little exercise to make those nodding off in the back of the mumble, mumble, mumble. Behold a little mundane miracle, courtesy of mumble, mumble, mumble." A frisson of excitement had woken everyone up. The doctor uncorked the smoky bottle and made a jerky movement. They could all see a small puff of dust, like an effervescence of talcum powder, jostle itself in a swimming plume in the air above the neck of the bottle. The doctor rode his hands a couple of times to start the air currents eddying upward. Keeping some rare sort of spatial coherence, the plume began to migrate upward and over. The oohs that the students were inclined to make were all postponed. Dr. Nikodik held a finger out to them to shush them, and they could tell why. A vast intake of breath would change the pattern of air currents and divert the floating musk of powder. But the students began to smile despite themselves. Above the stage, amid the standard ceremonial stag's horns and brass trumpets on braid, hung four oil portraits of the founding fathers of Ozma Towers. In their ancient garb and serious expressions, they looked down on today's students. If this biological intention were to be applied to one of the founding fathers, what would he say, seeing men and women students together in the great hall? What would he have to say about anything? It was a grand moment of anticipation. But when a door to the side of the stage opened, the mechanics of the air currents were disturbed. A student looked in, puzzled. A new student, oddly dressed in suede leggings and a white cotton shirt, with a pattern of blue diamonds tattooed on the dark skin of his face and hands. No one had seen him before, or anyone like him. Bach clutched Elphaba's hand tightly and whispered, "Look! A Winky!" And so it seemed, a student from the Vincus, in strange ceremonial garb, coming late for class, opening the wrong door, confused and apologetic. But the door had shut behind him and locked from this side, and there were no nearby seats available in the front rows. So he dropped where he was, and sat with his back against the door, hoping, no doubt, to look inconspicuous.
"Drat and damn, the thing's been shabbed off course," said Dr. Nikodik. "You fool! Why don't you come to class on time?"
The shining mist, about the size of a bouquet of flowers, had veered upward in a draft, and it bypassed the ranks of long-dead dignitaries, waiting an unexpected chance to speak again. Instead, it cloaked one of the racks of antlers, seeming for a few moments to hang itself on the twisting prongs.
"Well, I can scarcely hope to hear a word of wisdom from them, and I refuse to waste any more of this precious commodity on classroom demonstrations," said Dr. Nikodik. "The research is still incomplete, and I had thought that mumble, mumble, mumble. Let you discover for yourselves if mumble, mumble, mumble. I should hardly wish to prejudice your mumble."
The antlers suddenly took a convulsive twist on the wall and wrenched themselves out of the oaken paneling. They tumbled and clattered to the floor, to the shrieking and laughing of the students, especially because, for a minute, Dr. Nikodik didn't know what the uproar was about. He turned around in time to see the antlers right themselves and wait, quivering, twitching on the dais, like a fighting cock all nastied up and ready to go into the ring.
"Oh, well, don't look at me," said Dr. Nikodik, collecting his books. "I didn't ask for anything from you. Blame that one if you must."
And he casually pointed at the Vincus student, who was cowering so wide-eyed that the more cynical of the older students began to suspect this was all a set-up. The antlers stood on their points and skittered crab-like across the stage. As the students rose in a common scream, the antlers scrabbled up the body of the Vincus boy and pinned him against the locked door. One wing of the rack caught him by the neck, shackling him in its V-yoke, and the other reared back in the air to stab him in the face. Dr. Nikodik tried to move fast and fell to his arthritic knees. But before he could right himself, two boys were up on the stage, out of the front row, grabbing the antlers and wrestling them to the ground. The Vincus boy shrieked in a foreign tongue. "That's Crope and Tibbet," said Bach, jouncing Elphaba in the shoulder. "Look!" The sorcery students were all jumping on their seats and trying to lob spells at the murderous antlers, and Crope and Tibbet found their grips and lost them and found them again, until at last they succeeded in breaking off one driving tine, then another, and the pieces, still twitching, fell to the stage floor without further momentum. "Oh, the poor guy," said Bach, for the Vinca student had slumped down and was volubly weeping behind his blue-diamonded hands. "I never saw a student from the Vincus before. What an awful welcome to Shiz!" The attack on the Vincus student provoked gossip and speculation. In sorcery the next day, Glinda asked Miss Grayling to explain something. How could Dr. Nikodik's extract of biological intention, or whatever it was, how could it fall under the heading of life sciences when it behaved like a master spell? What really is the difference between science and sorcery?
Ah,
said Miss Grayling, choosing this moment to apply herself to the care of her hair. Science, my dears, is the systematic dissection of nature to reduce it to working parts that more or less obey universal laws. Sorcery moves in the opposite direction. It doesn't rend, it repairs. It is synthesis rather than analysis. It builds anew rather than revealing the old. In the hands of someone truly skilled, at this she jabbed herself with a hairpin and yelped, it is art. One might in fact call it the superior or the finest art. It bypasses the fine arts of painting and drama and recitation. It doesn't pose or represent the world. It becomes a very noble calling. She began to weep softly with the force of her own rhetoric. Can there be a higher desire than to change the world? Not to draw utopian blueprints, but really to order change? To revise the misshapen, reshape the mistaken, to justify the margins of this ragged error of a universe? Through sorcery to survive? At tea-time, still awed and amused, Glinda reported Miss Grayling's little heartfelt speech to the two Thropp sisters. Nessa Rose said, "Only the unnamed God creates, Glinda. If Miss Grayling confuses sorcery with creation, she is in grave danger of corrupting your morals." "Well," said Glinda, thinking of Amma Clutch on the bed of mental pain Glinda had once imagined for her. "My morals aren't in the greatest shape to start out with, Nessa."
"Then, if sorcery is to be helpful at all, it must be in reconstructing your character," said Nessa Rose firmly. "If you apply yourself in that direction, I suspect it will be all right in the end. Use your talent at sorcery. Don't be used by it."
Glinda suspected that Nessa Rose might develop a knack for being witheringly superior. She winced in advance, even while taking Nessa Rose's suggestion to heart. But Elphaba said, "Glinda, that was a good question. I wish Miss Grayling had answered it. That little nightmare with the antlers looked more like magic than science to me, too. The poor Vincus fellow. Suppose we ask Dr. Nicodick next week."
"Whoever would have the courage to do that?" cried Glinda. "Miss Grayling is at least ridiculous. Dr. Nicodick, with that lovable, bumbling, mumbling, incoherent way he has, he's so distinguished."
At the life sciences lecture the following week, all eyes were on the new Vincus boy. He arrived early and settled himself in the balcony, about as far from the lectern as he could get. Bach had the suspicion of nomads all settled farmers possessed, but Bach had to admit that the expression in the new boy's eyes was intelligent. Averick, sliding into the seat next to Bach, said, "He's a prince, they say. A prince without a purse or a throne. A pauper noble. In his particular tribe, I mean. He stays at Ozma Towers, and his name is Fiyero. He's a real Winky, full blood. Wonder what he makes of civilization." If that was civilization last week, he must long for his own barbaric kind, said Elphaba, from the seat on the other side of Bach.
"What's he wearing such silly paint for?" said Averick. "He only draws attention to himself. And that skin! I wouldn't want to have skin the color of shit."
"What a thing to say!" said Elphaba. "If you ask me, that's a shitty opinion." "Oh, please," said Bach. "Let's just shut up."
"I forgot, Elfie. Skin is your issue, too," said Averick.
"Leave me out of this," she said. "We just had lunch, and you give me dyspepsia, Averick. You and the beans we had at lunch." "I'm changing my seat," warned Bach. But Dr. Nicodick came in just then, and the class rose to its feet in routine respect, then settled back noisily, chummily, chattering. For a few minutes, Elphaba waved her hand to get the doctor's attention, but she was sitting too far back, and he was burbling on about something else. She finally leaned over to Bok and said, "At the recess, I'll change my seat and go forward so he can see me." Then the class watched as Dr. Nikodik finished his inaudible preamble and beckoned a student to open the same door at the side of the stage that Fiyero had stumbled through the previous week. In came a boy from Three Queens, rolling a table like a tea tray. On it, crouched as if to make itself as small as possible, was a lion cub. Even from the balcony they could sense the terror of the beast, its tail, a little whip the color of mashed peanuts, lashed back and forth, and its shoulders hunched. It had no mane to speak of yet, it was too tiny. But the tawny head twisted this way and that, as if counting the threats. It opened its mouth in a little terrified yawp, the infant form of an adult roar. All over the room hearts melted, and people said, "Aww."
"Hardly more than a kitten," said Dr. Nikodik. "I had thought to call it purr, but it shivers more often than it purrs, so I call it burr instead."
The creature looked at Dr. Nikodik and removed itself to the far edge of the trolley.
"Now the question of the morning is this," said Dr. Nikodik. "Picking up from the somewhat skewed interests of Dr. Dillamond, who mumble, mumble, who can tell me if this is an animal or an animal?"
Elphaba didn't wait to be called on. She stood up in the balcony and launched her answer out in a clear, strong voice.
"Dr. Nikodik, the question you asked was, who can tell if this is an animal or an animal? It seems to me the answer is that its mother can. Where is its mother?"
A buzz of amusement.
"Caught in the swamp of syntactical semantics, I see," said the doctor merrily.
He spoke louder, as if having only now realized that there was a balcony in the hall.
"Well done, miss. Let me rephrase the question. Will someone here venture a hypothesis as to the nature of this specimen, and give a reason for such an assessment? We see before us a beast at a tender age, long before any such beast could command language, if language were part of its makeup. Before language, assuming language, is this still an animal?"
"I repeat my question, doctor," sang out Elphaba. "This is a very young cub. Where is its mother? Why is it taken from its mother at such an early age? How even can it feed?"
"Those are impertinent questions to the academic issue at hand," said the doctor. "Still, the youthful heart bleeds easily. The mother, shall we say, died in a sadly timed explosion. Let us presume, for the sake of argument, that there was no way of telling whether the mother was a lioness or a lioness. After all, as you may have heard, some animals are going back to the wild to escape the implications of the current laws."
Elphaba sat down nonplussed. "It doesn't seem right to me," she said to Bok and Averick, "for the sake of a science lesson to drag a cub in here without its mother. Look how terrified it is. It is shivering, and it can't be cold." Other students began to venture opinions, but the doctor shot them down one by one. The point being, apparently, that without language or contextual clues, at its infant stages, a beast was not clearly animal or animal.
"This has a political implication," said Elphaba loudly. "I thought this was life sciences, not current events."
Bok and Averick shushed her. She was getting a terrible reputation as a loudmouth. The doctor dragged the episode out long after everyone had digested the point. But finally he turned and said,
"Now, do you think that if we could cauterize that part of the brain that develops language, we could eliminate the notion of pain, and thus its existence? Early tests on this little Tom Lion show interesting results."
He had picked up a small hammer with a rubber head and a syringe. The beast drew itself up and hissed, and then backed up and fell on the floor and streaked toward the door, which had closed and locked from this side, as it had the previous week. But it wasn't only Elphaba who was on her feet yelling. Half a dozen students were shouting at the doctor. "Pain! Eliminate pain! Look at the thing! It's terrified! It already gets pain! Don't do that! What are you, crazy?" The doctor paused, visibly tightening his grip on the mallet.
"I will not preside over such shocking refusal to learn," he said, affronted. "You are leaping to harebrained conclusions based on sentiment and no observation. Bring the beast here. Bring it back. Young lady, I insist. I shall be quite cross."
But two girls from Briscoe Hall disobeyed and ran out of the room carrying the clawing lion cub in an apron between them. The room collapsed in an uproar, and Dr. Nicodick stalked off the stage. Elphaba turned to Bok and said, "Well, I guess I don't get to ask Glinda's good question about the difference between science and sorcery, do I? We were definitely headed down a different path today." But her voice was shaking. "You felt for that beast, didn't you?" Bok was touched. "Elphie, you're trembling. I don't mean this in an insulting way, but you've nearly gone white with passion. Come on, let's sneak out and get a tea at the cafe at Railway Square, for old time's sake." Perhaps every accidental cluster of people has a short period of grace, in between the initial shyness and prejudice on the one hand, and eventual repugnance and betrayal on the other. For Bok, it seemed that his summer obsession with the then Glinda made sense, if only to usher in this following, more mature comfort with a circle of friends who had begun to feel inevitably and permanently connected. The boys still weren't allowed access to Craig Hall, nor the girls to the boys' schools, but the city center area of Shiz became an extension of the parlors and lecture halls in which they were allowed to mingle. On a midweek afternoon, on a weekend morning, they would meet by the canal with a bottle of wine, or in a cafe or student watering hole, or they would walk about and discuss the fine points of Shiz architecture, or they would laugh about the excesses of their teachers. Bok and Averick, Elphaba and Nessa Rose with Nanny, Glinda and sometimes Fanet and Shen Shen and Miller, and sometimes Crope and Tibbet. And Crope brought Fiero along and introduced him, which frosted Tibbet for a week or so, until the evening that Fiero said in his shy, formal way,
"Of course, I have been married for some time. We marry young in the Vincus."
The others were agog at the notion and felt juvenile. To be sure, Elphaba and Averick needled each other mercilessly. Nessa Rose tried everyone's patience with her religious rantings. Crope's and Tibbet's stream of saucy remarks got them dumped in the canal more than once. But Bok was relieved to find that his crush on Glinda was lifting somewhat. She sat on the edge of the picnic blanket with a look of self-reliance, and she diverted conversation away from herself. He had loved the girl who had loved the glamour in herself, and that girl seemed to have disappeared. But he was happy to have Glinda as a friend. Well, in a nutshell, he had loved Glinda, and this now was Glinda. Someone he could no longer quite figure out. case closed. It was a charmed circle. All the girls steered clear of Madame Morrible while they could. One cold evening, however, Grammatic came hunting for the Thropp sisters. Nanny huffed and wound the strings of a fresh apron around her waist, and prodded Nessa Rose and Elphaba downstairs toward the parlor of the head.
"I hate that Grammatic thing," said Nessa Rose. "However does it work, anyway? Is it clockwork, or is it magicked, or some combination of the two?"
"I always imagined a bit of nonsense, that there was a dwarf inside, or an acrobatic family of elves, each working a limb," said Elphaba. "Whenever Grammatic comes around, my hand gets a strange hunger for a hammer."
"I can't imagine," Nessa Rose said. "Hand hunger, I mean."
"Hush, you two. The thing has ears," Nanny said. Madame Morrible was glancing through the financial papers, making a few marks in the margin before she deigned to acknowledge her students.
"This won't take but a moment," she said. "I've had a letter from your dear father, and a package for you. I thought it kindest to deliver the news myself."
"News?" said Nessa Rose, blanching.
"He could have written to us as well as to you," said Elphaba. Madame Morrible ignored her.
"He writes to ask of Nessa Rose's health and progress, and to tell you both that he is going to undertake a fast and penance for the return of Ozma Tipitarius."
"Oh, the blessed little girl," said Nanny, warming to one of her favorite subjects.
"When the wizard took over the palace all those years ago, and he had the Ozma regent jailed, we all thought that the sainted Ozma child would call down disaster upon the wizard's head, but they say she's been spirited away and frozen in a cave, like Lurlina. Has Frexbar got the metal to melt her? Is now her time to return?"
"Please,"
said Madame Morrible to the sisters, with a sour glance at Nanny. "I haven't asked you here so that your Nanny could discuss this contemporary apocrypha, nor to slander our glorious wizard. It was a peaceful transition of power. That the Ozma regent's health failed while under house arrest was a mere coincidence, nothing more. As to the power of your father to raise the missing royal child from some unsubstantiated state of somnolence, well, you've as much as admitted to me that your father is erratic, if not mad. I can only wish him health in his endeavors. But I feel it my duty to point out to you girls that we do not smile on seditious attitudes at Craig Hall. I hope you have not imported your father's royalist yearnings into the dormitories here."
"We assign ourselves to the unnamed god, not to the wizard nor to any possible remnant of the royal family," Nessa Rose said proudly.
"I have no feeling on the matter at all," muttered Elphaba, "except that father loves lost causes."
"Very well," said the head. "As it should be. Now, I have had a package for you."
She handed it to Elphaba, but added, "It is for Nessa Rose, I think."
"Open it, Elfie, please," said Nessa Rose.
Nanny leaned forward to look. Elphaba undid the cord and opened the wooden box. From a pile of ash shavings, she withdrew a shoe, and then another. Were they silver, or blue, or now red, lacquered with a candy-shell brilliance of polish? It was hard to tell, and it didn't matter. The effect was dazzling. Even Madame Morrible gasped at their splendor. The surface of the shoes seemed to pulse with hundreds of reflections and refractions. In the firelight, it was like looking at boiling corpuscles of blood under a magnifying glass.
"He writes that he bought them for you from some toothless tinker woman outside Ovals,"
said Madame Morrible, "and that he dressed them up with silver glass beads that he made himself, that someone had taught him to make."
"Turtle heart," said Nanny darkly.
"And," Madame Morrible flipped the letter over, squinting, "he says he had hoped to give you something special before you left for university, but in the sudden circumstances of Amma Clutch's sickness, blah, blah, he was unprepared. So now he sends them to his Nesseros to keep her beautiful feet warm and dry and beautiful, and he sends them with his love." Elphaba drove her fingers through the curlicues of shavings. There was nothing else in the box, nothing for her.
"Aren't they gorgeous?" Nesseros exclaimed. "Elfie, fix them on my feet, would you please? Oh, how they sparkle!"
Elphaba went on her knees before her sister. Nesseros sat as regal as any Ozma, spine erect and face glowing. Elphaba lifted her sister's feet and slipped off the common house slippers and replaced them with the dazzling shoes.
"How thoughtful he is," said Nesseros.
"Good thing you can stand on your own two feet, you," muttered Nanny to Elphaba, and put her old hand patronizingly on Elphaba's shoulder blades, but Elphaba shrugged it away.
"They're just gorgeous," said Elphaba thickly. "Nesseros, they're made for you. They fit like a dream."
"Oh, Elfie, don't be cross," Nesseros said, looking down at her feet. "Don't ruin my small happiness with resentment, will you? He knows you don't need this kind of thing."
"Of course not," said Elphaba. "Of course I don't."
That evening, the friends risked breaking curfew by ordering another bottle of wine. Nanny tutted and fretted, but as she kept downing her portion as neatly as anyone else, she was overruled. Fihiro told the story of how he had been married at the age of 7 to a girl from a neighboring tribe. They all gawped at his apparent lack of shame. He had only seen his bride once, by accident, when they were both about 9.
"I won't really take up with her until we are 20, and I'm now only 18," he added.
With the relief of imagining he might still be as virginal as the rest of them, they ordered yet another bottle of wine. The candles guttered, a small autumnal rain fell. Though the room was dry, Elphaba drew her cloak about her, as if anticipating the walk home. She had gotten over the sting of being overlooked by Frex. She and Nesseros began to tell funny stories about their father, as if to prove to themselves and to everyone else that nothing was amiss. Nesseros, who wasn't much of a drinker, allowed herself to laugh.
"Despite my appearance, or maybe because of it, he always called me his beautiful pet," she said, alluding to her lack of arms for the first time in public. "He would say, 'Come here, my pet, and let me give you a piece of apple.' And I would walk over as best I could, tilting and tottering if Nanny or Elfie or Mother wasn't around to support me, and fall into his lap and lean up smiling, and he'd drop small pieces of fruit into my mouth."
"What did he call you, Elfie?" asked Glinda.
"He called her Fabula," interrupted Nesseros.
At home only," Elphaba said.
"True, you are your father's little Fabula," crooned Nanny almost to herself, just outside the circle of smiling faces. "Little Fabula, little Elphaba, little Elfie."
"He never called me pet," said Elphaba, raising her glass to her sister.
"But we all know he told the truth, as Nesseros is the pet in the family. Hence those splendid shoes."
Nesseros blushed and accepted a toast.
"Ah,
But while I had his attention because of my condition, you captured his heart when you sang, she said.
Captured his heart? Ha! You mean I performed a necessary function.
But the others said to Elphaba, Oh, do you sing?
Well, then sing. Sing you must. Another bottle, another glass. Push back the chair, and before we leave for the night, you must sing. Go on.
Only if the others will, said Elphaba, bossily.
Bach, some Munchkinlander spinel, Averick, a Gilliconese ballad, Glinda, Nanny, a lullaby.
We know a dirty round. We'll go next if you go, said Crope and Tibbet.
And I will sing a Vincus hunting chant, said Fiero. Everyone chortled with pleasure and clapped him on the back.
So then Elphaba had to stand, push her chair aside, clear her throat, and sound a note into her cupped hands, and start, as if she were singing for her father again after all this time. The bar mother slapped her rag at some noisy older men to shush them, and the dart players dropped their hands to their sides. The room quieted down. Elphaba made up a little song on the spot, a song of longing and otherness, of faraways and future days. Strangers closed their eyes to listen. Bach did too. Elphaba had an okay voice. He saw the imaginary place she conjured up, a land where injustice and common cruelty and despotic rule and the beggaring fist of drought didn't work together to hold everyone by the neck. No, he wasn't giving her credit. Elphaba had a good voice. It was controlled and feeling and not histrionic. He listened through to the end, and the song faded into the hush of a respectful pub. Later, he thought, the melody faded like a rainbow after a storm, or like winds calming down at last, and what was left was calm and possibility and relief.
"You next, you promised," cried Elphaba, pointing at Fiero. But nobody would sing again, because she had done so well. Nessa Rose nodded to Nanny to wipe a tear from the corner of her eye.
Elphaba says she's not religious, but see how feelingly she sings of the afterlife, said Nessa Rose, and for once no one was inclined to argue. Early one morning, when the world was hoary with rime frost, Grammatik arrived with a note for Glinda. Amma Clutch, it seemed, was on her way out. Glinda and her roommates hurried to the infirmary. The head met them there and led them to a windowless alcove. Amma Clutch was thrashing about in the bed and talking to the pillowcase.
"Don't put up with me," she was saying wildly. "For what will I ever do for you? I will abuse your good nature, ducky, and rest my oily locks upon your fine, close weave, and I will be picking with my teeth at your lacy appliqued edge. You are a stupid nuisance to allow it, I say. I don't care about notions of service. It's all bunk, I tell you, bunk!"
I'm a clutch, it's me," said Glinda. "Listen, dear, it's me. It's your little Glinda." Amma Clutch turned her head from side to side.
"Your protest is insulting to your forebears," she went on, rolling her eyes toward the pillowcase again. "Those cotton plants on the banks of Restwater didn't allow themselves to be harvested so you could lie down like a mat and let any filthy person slobber all over you with night drool. It don't make a lick of sense."
"Amma," Glinda wept, "please, you're raving."
"Aha! I see you have nothing to say to that," said Amma Clutch with satisfaction.
"Come back, Amma, come back one more time before you go."
"Oh, sweet Lurline, this is dreadful," Nanny said.
"Darlings, if I ever get like this, poison me, will you?"
"She's going. I can see it," Elphaba said. "I saw it enough in Quaddling Country. I know the signs. Glinda, say what you need to say quickly."
"Madame Morrible, may I have privacy?" Glinda said.
"I will stay by your side and support you. It's my duty to my girls," said the head, settling her ham-like hands determinedly on her waist. But Elphaba and Nanny got up and elbowed her out of the alcove, down the hall, and through the door, and closed it and locked it. Nanny clucked all the while, saying,
"Now isn't that nice of you, Madam Head, but no need, no need at all."
Glinda gripped Amma Clutch's hand. Beads of white sweat were forming like potato water on the servant's forehead. She struggled to pull her hand away, but her strength was going.
"Amma Clutch, you're dying," Glinda said, "and it's my fault."
"Oh, stop," Elphaba said. "It is," Glinda said fiercely, "it is."
"I'm not arguing that," said Elphaba. "I just mean cut yourself out of the conversation. This is her death, not your interview with the unnamed god. Come on, do something."
Glinda grabbed the hands, both hands, even tighter.
"I am going to magic you back," she said between gritted teeth. "Amma Clutch, you do as I say. I'm still your employer and your better, and you have to obey me. Now listen to this spell and behave yourself."
The Amma's teeth gnashed, the eyes rolled, and the chin twisted knobbly, as if trying to impale some invisible demon in the air above her bed. Glinda's eyes shut and her jaw worked, and a thread of sound, syllables incoherent even to herself, came spooling out from her blanched lips.
"Hope you don't explode her like a sandwich," muttered Elphaba.
Glinda ignored this. She hummed and worked, she rocked and panted. Amma Clutch's eyelids moved so frantically over the closed eyes that it looked as if her eye sockets were chewing her own eyes.
"Magic cordium sensus ovinda clenks," Glinda concluded out loud. "And if that doesn't do it, I give up. Even the smells and bells of a full kit wouldn't help, I think."
On the straw pallet, Amma Clutch fell back. A little blood ran from the outer edge of each eye. But the wild turning motion of the focus had shuttered itself down.
"Oh, my dear," she murmured. "So you're all right, then, or am I dead now?"
"Not yet," said Glinda. "Yes, dear Amma, yes, I'm fine. But, sweetheart, I think you're going."
"Of course I am. The wind is here. Can't you hear it?" Amma Clutch said. "No matter. Oh, there's Elfie, too. Goodbye, my ducks. Stay out of the wind until the time is right, or you'll be blown in the wrong direction."
Glinda said, "Amma Clutch, I have something to say to you. I have to make my apology." But Elphaba leaned forward, cutting Glinda off from Amma Clutch's line of sight, and said, "Amma Clutch, before you go, tell us who killed Dr. Dillamond."
"Surely you know that," Amma Clutch said.
"Make us sure," Elphaba said.
"Well, I saw it. I mean, nearly. It had just happened, and the knife was still there."
Amma Clutch worked for breath.
"Smeared with blood that hadn't had a chance to dry."
"What did you see? This is important."
"I saw the knife in the air. I saw the wind come to take Dr. Dillamond away. I saw the clockwork turn and the goat's time stop."
"It was Grammatic, wasn't it?" Elphaba murmured, trying to get the old woman to speak the words.
"Well, that's what I'm saying, ducky," said Amma Clutch.
"And did it see you? Did it turn on you?" cried Glinda. "Did that make you ill, Amma Clutch?"
"It was my time to be ill," said Amma Clutch gently.
so I couldn't complain. And it is my time to die, so leave me be. Just hold my hand, dear. But the fault is mine, began Glinda. You would do me more good if you hushed, sweet Galinda, my duck, said Amma Clutch gently, and patted Glinda's hand. Then she closed her eyes and breathed in and out a couple of times. They sat there in a silence that seemed peculiarly servant-class Gilliknese, though it was hard later on to explain why. Outside, Madame Morrible moved up and down the floorboards, pacing. Then they imagined they heard a wind, or an echo of a wind, and Amma Clutch was gone, and the overly subordinate pillowcase took a small spill of human juice from the edge of her slackened mouth. The funeral was modest, a love-her-and-shove-her affair. Glinda's close friends attended, filling two pews, and in the second tier of the chapel a flock of amas made a professional coterie. The rest of the chapel was empty. After the corpse in its winding sheet slid along the oiled chute to the furnace, the mourners and colleagues retired to Madame Morrible's private parlour, where she proved to have sanctioned no expense in the refreshments. The tea was ancient stock, stale as sawdust, the biscuits were hard, and there was no saffron cream or tamorna marmalade. Glinda said reprovingly to the head, "Not even a small bowl of cream?" And Madame Morrible answered, "My girl, I try to protect my charges from the worst of the food shortages, by judicious shopping and by going without myself, but I am not wholly responsible for your ignorance. If only people would obey the wizard absolutely, there would be abundance. Don't you realize that conditions verge on famine, and cows are dying of starvation 200 miles from here? This makes saffron cream very dear in the market." Glinda began to move away, but Madame Morrible reached out a raft of cushiony, bulbous, bejeweled fingers. The touch made Glinda's blood run cold. "I should like to see you and Miss Nessa Rose and Miss Elphaba," said the head. "After the guests leave, please wait behind." "We're nabbed for a lecture," whispered Glinda to the Thropp sisters. "We have to be yelled at." "Not a word about what Amma Clutch said, or that she came back," said Elphaba urgently. "Got that, Nessa? Nanny?" They all nodded. Bach and Averick, making their goodbyes, said that the group was reconvening at the pub in the Regent's Parade. The girls agreed to meet them there after their interview with the head. They would manage a more honest memorial service for Amma Clutch at the Peach and Kidneys. When the small crowd had dispersed, only Grammatic clearing away the cups and crumbs, Madame Morrible herself banked up the fire, a gesture of chumminess lost on no one, and sent Grammatic away. "Later, thingy," she said. "Later. Go lubricate yourself in some closet somewhere." Grammatic wheeled away with, if it was possible, an offended air. Elphaba had to repress an urge to kick it with the tip of her stout black walking boot. "You too, Nanny," Madame Morrible said. "A little break from your labors."
"Oh, no," Nanny said. "Nanny doesn't leave her Nessa."
"Yes, Nanny does. Her sister is perfectly capable of caring for her," said the head. "Aren't you, Miss Elphaba, the very soul of charity?" Elphaba opened her mouth. The word soul always provoked her, Glinda knew, but closed it again. She made a wincing nod toward the door. Without a word, Nanny got up to leave, but before the door closed behind her, Nanny said,
"It's not my place to complain, but really, no cream at a funeral?"
"Help," said Madame Morrible when the door closed.
but Glinda wasn't sure if this was a criticism of servants or a bid for sympathy. The head rallied herself by arranging her skirts and the vents and braids of her smart parlor jacket. In orangey copper sequins, she looked like a huge, upholstered, upended goldfish goddess. How ever did she get to be head? Glinda wondered. Now that Amma Clutch has gone to ash, we shall, nay, we must move bravely on, Madame Orrible began. My girls, may I first ask you to recount the sad story of her last words. It is essential therapy on your recovery from grief. The girls didn't look at one another. Glinda, in this situation, the spokesperson, took a breath and said, Oh, she spewed nonsense to the last. No surprise, the dotty old thing, said Madame Orrible. But what nonsense? We couldn't make it out, said Glinda. I had wondered if she talked about the death of the goat. Glinda said, Oh, the goat! Well, I could hardly tell. I suspected that in her deranged condition she might return to that critical moment. The dying often try to make sense at the last possible moment of the puzzles of their lives. Useless effort, of course. No doubt Amma Clutch was puzzled by what she came across, the goat's body, the blood, and Grammatic. Oh, said Glinda faintly. The sisters beside her were careful not to stir. That terrible morning I was up early at my spiritual meditations, and I noticed the light in Dr. Dillamond's lab. So I sent Grammatic over with a cheering pot of tea for the old goat. Grammatic found the animal slumped over a broken lens. He'd apparently stumbled and severed his own jugular vein. Such a sad accident, born of academic zeal, not to say hubris, and a pitiful lack of common sense. Rest. We all need rest. The brightest of us need our rest. Grammatic, in its confusion, felt for a pulse. None to be found. And I surmise that is just when Amma Clutch arrived. To see dear Grammatic splashed with the spurts of a strong circulatory pulse. Amma Clutch arrived out of nowhere, and none of her business, I might add, but let's not malign the dead, shall we? Glinda gulped back new tears, and did not mention that Amma Clutch had mentioned seeing something unusual the evening before, and had wandered out to check. I did always think that the shock of all that blood might have been the final straw that sent Amma Clutch pitching back into her ailment. Incidentally, you see why I dismissed Grammatic just now. It's still very sensitive, and suspects, I believe, that Amma Clutch thought it responsible for the goat's slaughter. Glinda said waveringly, Madame Orrible, you should know that Amma Clutch had never suffered such a disease as I described to you. I invented it. But I didn't assign it. I didn't commit it to her, or her to it. Elphaba looked at Madame Orrible steadily, keeping her interest modest. Nessarosa's eyelashes fluttered. If Madame Orrible knew Glinda's news already, her face didn't give her away. She looked as placid as a tethered rowboat. "Well, this only lends weight to my observations," she allowed. "There is an imaginative, even a prophetic power in your pointed little society skull, Miss Glinda." The head stood, her skirts rustling, wind through a field of wheat. What I say now, I say in strictest confidence. I expect my girls to obey my command. Are we agreed? She seemed to take their stunned silence as assent. She looked down on them. That's why she seems so like a fish, Glinda suddenly thought. She hardly ever blinks.
By an authority vested in me that is too high to be named, I have been charged with a crucial task, said the head. A task essential to the internal security of Oz. I have been working to fulfill this task for some years, and the time is right, and the goods are at my disposal.
She scrutinized them. They were the goods.
You will not repeat what you hear in this room, she said. You will not want to. You will not choose to, and you will not be able to. I am wrapping each one of you in a binding cocoon as regards this very sensitive material. No,
she held up a hand at Elphaba's protest.
No, you have no right to object. The deed is already done, and you must listen and be open to what I say.
Glinda tried to examine herself to see if she felt wrapped or bound or spell-chilled. But she only felt frightened and young, which may be close to the same thing. She glanced at the sisters. Nessa Rose, in her dazzling shoes, was back in her chair, nostrils dilating in fright or excitement. Elphaba, on the other hand, looked as stolid and cross as usual.
"You live in a little womb here, a tight little nest, girl with girl. Oh, I know you have your silly boys on the edge, forgettable things. Good for one thing only, and not even reliable at that. But I digress. I must say that you know little or nothing of the state of the nation today. You have no sense of the pitch of unrest to which things have mounted, setting communities on edge, ethnic groups against one another, bankers against farmers and factories against shopkeepers. Oz is a seething volcano, threatening to erupt and burn us in its own poisonous pus. Our wizard seems strong enough. Ah, but is he? Is he really? He has a grasp of internal politics. He's no slouch at negotiating rates of exchange with the bloodsuckers of Ev or Jemico or Fleon. He rules the Emerald City with an industry and an ability that the decaying, knob-jawed Ozma line never dreamed of. Without him, we'd have been swept away in firestorm years ago. We can but be grateful. A strong fist does wonders in a rotten situation. Walk softly, but carry a big stick. I see I offend. Well, a man is always good for the public face of power, no?
Yes, but things are not always as they seem. And it has been clear for some time that the wizard's bag of tricks would not do forever. There are bound to be popular uprisings, the stupid, senseless kind, in which strong, dumb people enjoy getting killed for the sake of political changes that'll be rolled back within the decade. Add such meaning to meaningless lives, don't you think? One can't imagine any other reason for it. At any rate, the wizard needs some agents. He requires a few generals. In the long run, some people with managing skills. Some people with gumption. In a word, women. I have called you three girls in here. You are not women yet, but the moment is closing in on you faster than you might think. Despite my opinion as to your behavior, I have had to single you out. There is more in each one of you than meets the eye. Miss Nessa Rose, being the newest, you are the most hidden to me. But once you outgrow that fetching habit of faith, you will display a ferocious authority. Your bodily disorder is of no significance here. Miss Elphaba, you are an isolate, and even in my binding spell you sit there stewing in scorn of every word I say.
This is evidence of great internal power and force of will, something I deeply respect, even when marshaled against me. You have shown no sign of interest in sorcery, and I don't claim you have any natural aptitude, but your splendid lone wolf spit and spirit can be harnessed. Oh, yes, it can. And you needn't live a life of unfulfilled rage. And Miss Glinda, you have surprised yourself with the talents at sorcery you possess. I knew you would. I had hoped your inclinations might rub off on Miss Elphaba, but that they haven't is only firmer proof of Miss Elphaba's iron character. I see in your eyes you all question my methods. You think, somewhat wildly, did horrible Morrible cause that nail to pierce my armor clutch's foot, making me have to room with Elphaba? Did she cause armor clutch to come downstairs and find the dead goat, the better to get her out of the way and require Nanny, and thus Nessa Rose to show up on the scene? How flattering that you even imagine I have such power! The head paused and came near to blushing, which in her was something like the separating of cream on a flame set too high. "I am a handmaiden at the service of superiors," she continued, "and my special talent is to encourage talent. In my own small way, I have been called to a vocation of education, and here I make my little contributions to history. Now, to be specific, I want you to consider your futures. I would like to name you, to baptize you, as it were, as a trio of adepts. In the long run, I would like to assign you behind-the-scenes ministerial duties in different parts of the country. I am empowered to do this, remember, by those whose bootstraps I am not worthy to lick." But she looked smug, as if she thought herself quite worthy enough, indeed, of attention from these mysterious forces. "Let us say you will be secret partners of the highest level of government. You will be anonymous ambassadors of peace, helping to restrain the unruly element among our less civilized populations. Nothing is decided yet, of course, and you do have a say in the matter. A say to me, and not to each other, nor anyone else, as the spell goes. But I would like you to think about it. I need, eventually, to place an adept in Gilliken somewhere. Miss Glinda, with your middle-range social position and your transparent ambitions, you can slime your way into ballrooms of Margreaves and still be at home in the pigsties. Oh, don't squirm so. Your good blood is only on one side, and it's not a terribly refined strain anyway. The adept of Gilliken, Miss Glinda, does it appeal?" Glinda could only listen. "Miss Elphaba," said Madame Morrible, "full of the teenage scorn of inherited position, you are nonetheless the Thropp third descending, and your great-grandfather, the eminent Thropp, is in his dotage. One day you will inherit what is left of Colwyn Grounds, that pretentious pile in Nest Hardings, and you could manage to be the adept of Munchkinland. Your unfortunate skin condition notwithstanding, indeed perhaps because of it, you have developed a feistiness and an iconoclasm that is just faintly appealing when it doesn't nauseate. It will come in service, believe me. And Miss Nessa Rose," she went on, "having grown up in Quadling country, you will want to return there with Nanny. The social situation in Quadling Country is such a mess, what with the decimation of the squelchy froglet population. But it may come back in small measure, and there should be someone to oversee the ruby mines. We need someone to look after things in the south. Once you recover from your religious mania, it'll be a perfect setting. You don't expect a life of high society anyway, not without arms. After all, how can one dance without arms? As for the Vincus, we don't imagine we'll need an adept stationed there, at least not in your lifetimes. The master plans eradicate any appreciable population in that godforsaken place. Here the head paused and looked around. Oh, girls, I know you are young. I know this grieves you. You mustn't think of it as a prison sentence, though, but an opportunity. You ask yourselves, how will I grow in a position, albeit a silent one, of prominence and responsibility? How may my talents flourish? How, my dears, how may I help my Oz? Elphaba's foot twisted, caught the edge of a side table, and a cup and saucer fell to the floor and smashed. "You're so predictable," said Madame Morrible, sighing. "That's what makes my job so easy." "Now, girls, bound as you are to an oath of silence, I bid you to go away and think on what I have said. Please don't even try to discuss it together, as it'll just give you a headache and cramps. You won't be able to manage it. Sometime in the next semester, I will call each of you in here, and you can give me your answer. And if you should choose not to help your country in its hour of need..." She clasped her hands in a parody of despair. "Well, you are not the only fish in the sea, are you?" The afternoon had turned glowery, with heaps of plum-colored clouds in the north, beyond the bluestone spires and steeples. The temperature had dropped 20 degrees since the morning, and the girls kept their shawls pulled close as they walked to the pub. Nanny, shivering in the dirty wind, cried, "And what did the old busybody have to say that I couldn't be allowed to hear?" But there was nothing they could say. Glinda couldn't even meet the other's eyes. "We'll lift a glass of champagne for Amma Clutch," said Elphaba finally, "when we get to the peach and kidneys." "I'd settle for a spoonful of real cream," said Nanny. "How pinching that old sow is! No respect for the dead." But Glinda found that the binding spell was deeper, cut closer than she had even understood. It wasn't merely that they couldn't talk about it. Already she had begun to lose the words about it, to falter in her thinking, to fail to commit the interview to memory. There was the proposal. It was a proposal, wasn't it? Of some questionable proposition in, was it the civil service? Doing some ballroom dancing, which didn't make sense. Some laughing, a glass of champagne, a handsome man taking off his cummerbund and pressing his starched cuffs against her neck, nibbling the teardrop-shaped rubies at her ears. Talk softly, but carry a bit stick. Or was it not a proposal, but a prophecy? A little friendly encouragement about the future. And she had been alone. The others hadn't been listening. Madame Morrible had spoken directly to her. A lovely testimony to Glinda's potential. The chance to rise. Walk softly but marry a big prick. A man draping his evening tie on a bedstead and rolling his diamond studs, nudging them with his nose down the declivity of her superior neck.
It was a dream. Madame Morrible couldn't have said that. She must be dazed with grief. Poor Amma Clutch. It had only been a quiet word of condolence from the dear and self-effacing head who found it hard to speak in public. But a man's tongue between her legs, a spoonful of saffron cream. Nessa Rose said, "Catch her. I can't. I'm—" And she sagged against Nanny's bosom, and Glinda swooned at the same moment. Elphaba thrust out strong arms and scooped Glinda in mid-collapse. Glinda didn't really lose consciousness, but the uncomfortable physical nearness of hawk-faced Elphaba after that undesired act of desire made her want to shiver with revulsion and to purr at the same time. "Steady on, girl, not here," said Elphaba. "Resist, come on." Resist was just what Glinda didn't want to do. But after all, in the shadow of an apple cart, on the edge of the market where merchants were selling the last fish of the day cheap, well, this was hardly the place. "Tough, tough skin," said Elphaba, appearing to pull words from the back of her throat. "Come on, Glinda. You've got better brains. Come on. I love you too much. Snap out of it, you idiot." "Well, really," she said, as Elphaba dumped her on a heap of moldy packing straw. No need to be so romantic about it. But she felt better, as if a wave of illness had just passed. "You girls, I tell you, the faints. It comes from those tight shoes," said Nanny, huffing and loosening Nessa Rose's glamorous footwear. "Sensible folk wear leather or wood." She massaged Nessa Rose's insteps for a minute, and Nessa Rose moaned and arched her back, but began in a few moments to breathe more normally. "Welcome back to Oz," said Nanny after a while. "What goodies were you all snacking on in there with the head?" "Come on, they're waiting," said Elphaba. "No sense dawdling. Anyway, I'm afraid it might rain." At the Peach and Kidneys, the rest of the gang had commandeered a table in an alcove several steps above the main floor. They were well into their cups by that point in the afternoon, and it was clear tears had been shed. Averick sat slouched against the brick wall of the student den, one arm slung around Fiero, and his legs stretched out in Shen Shen's lap. Bok and Crope were arguing about something, anything, and Tibbet was singing an interminable song to Fanet, who looked as if she wanted to drive a dart into the thick of his thigh. "Ah, the ladies," slurred Averick, and made as if to rise. They sang and chattered and ordered sandwiches, and Averick plunked down an embarrassment of coins to demand a salver of saffron cream in Amma Clutch's memory. Money did wonders, and the cream was found in the larder, which gave Glinda an uneasy feeling, though she didn't know why. They spooned the airy mounds into one another's mouths, sculpted with it, mixed it in their champagne, threw it in small gobbets at one another, until the manager came over and told them to get the hell out. They complied, grumbling. They didn't know it was the last time they would all be together, or they might have lingered. A brisk rain had come and gone, but the streets were still noisy with runoff, and the lamplight glistened and danced in the silvery black curvets of water caught among the cobbles. Imagining the possible brigand in the shadows, or the hungry wanderer lurking nearby, they stood close together. "I've got an idea," said Averick, putting one foot this way and the other that, as if he were as flexible as a man of straw. "Who's man enough
for the philosophy club tonight.
Oh, no, you don't, said Nanny, who hadn't had that much to drink.
I want to go, whined Nessa Rose, swaying more than usual.
You don't even know what it is, said Bach, giggling and hiccuping.
I don't care. I don't want to leave tonight, Nessa Rose said. We only have one another, and I don't want to be left out, and I don't want to go home.
Hush, Nessa. Hush, hush, my pretty, said Elphaba. That's not the place for you or me either. Come on, we're going home. Glinda, come on.
I have no armor now, said wide-eyed Glinda, stabbing a finger toward Elphaba. I am my own agent. I want to go to the philosophy club and see if it's true.
The rest can do what they want, but we're going home, said Elphaba. Glinda veered over toward Elphaba, who was homing in on a very uncertain-looking Bach.
Now, Bach, you don't want to go to that disgusting place, do you? Elphaba was saying. Come on, don't let the boys make you do something you don't want.
You don't know me, he said, appearing to address the hitching post. Elfie, how do you know what I want? Unless I find out,
Come with us, said Fiero to Elphaba. Please, if we ask you politely.
I want to go too, whined Glinda.
Oh, come, Glinny-dinny, said Bach. Maybe they'll pick us, for old time's sake, as never was.
The others had awakened a slumbering cab driver and hired his services.
Bach, Glinda, Elfie, come on, Averick called from the window. Where's your nerve?
Bach, think about this, Elphaba urged.
I always think. I never feel. I never live, he moaned. Can't I live once in a while? Just once? Just because I'm short? I'm not an infant, Elfie.
Not till now, said Elphaba. Rather smarmy tonight, thought Glinda, and wrenched herself away to climb into the cab. But Elphaba grabbed her by the elbow and pivoted her around.
You can't, she whispered. We're going to the Emerald City.
I'm going to the Philosophy Club with my friends.
Tonight, hissed Elphaba, you little idiot. We have no time to waste on sex.
Nanny had led Nessa Rose away already, and the cabby clucked his reins, and the equipage lumbered away. Glinda stumbled and said,
What did you think you were just about to say?
To say?
I already said it, and I'm not saying it again, said Elphaba. My dear, you and I are going back to Craig Hall tonight, only to pack a valise. Then we're away.
But the gates'll be locked.
It's over the garden wall, said Elphaba, and we're going to see the wizard, come what may, and hell to pay.
Bach could not believe he was heading to the Philosophy Club at last. He hoped he wouldn't vomit at a crucial moment. He hoped he would remember the whole thing tomorrow, or at least some kernel of it, despite the headache forming vengefully in the hollows at his temples. The place was discreet, though it was the best-known dive in Shiz. It hid behind a facade of panelled-up windows. A couple of apes roamed the street in front, bouncing troublemakers ahead of time. Averick counted the party carefully as they fell from the cab. Shen Shen, Crope, me, Bach, Tibbet, Fiero, and Fanet. 7. Boy, how'd we all fit in the cab? Could hardly fit us, I'd think.
He paid the cabbie and tipped him, in some obscure homage still to Amma Clutch, and then pushed to the front of the silent knot of companions.
"Come on! We're the right age and the right drunk,"
he said, and to the shadowed face at the window, "Seven. Seven of us, good sir." The face came forward to the glass and leered at him.
"The name is Yackel, and I'm not a sir, nor am I good. What kind are you up to tonight, master fellow?"
Speaking through the pane was a crone, with random teeth and a shiny white-pink wig slipping westwards off her pearly scalp. "Kind?" said Averick. Then, more bravely, "Any kind."
"I mean the ticket, sweetbread. Strutting and strumming on the sprung floor, or strumpeting in the old wine cellars?"
"The works," said Averick.
"You understand house rules, the locked doors, the if-you-pay-you-play policy?"
"Give us seven and hurry up about it. We're not fools."
"You never are fools," said the beastly woman. "Well, here you are, then, and come what may, or who may."
She affected a stance of virtue, like a painting of a Unionist virgin saint.
"Enter and be saved."
The door swung open, and they went down a flight of uneven brick steps. At the bottom of the flight was a dwarf in a purple burnous. He looked at their tickets and said,
"Where are you soft things from? Out of town?"
"We're all at the university," said Averick.
"A motley crew. Well, you've seven of diamond tickets. See here the seven red diamonds printed here and here," he said. "Have a drink on the house, watch the girly show, and dance a little if you want. Every hour or so I close this street door and open the next."
He pointed to a huge oak door barred with two monstrous timbers in iron hasps.
"You all go in together or you don't go in at all. That's the rule of the house."
There was a chanteuse singing a send-up of What is Oz Without Ozma, and teasing herself with a parrot-colored feather boa. A small band of elves, real elves, tootled and rattled out a tinny accompaniment. Bach had never seen an elf, even though he knew there was a colony of them not far from Rush Margins.
"How weird," he said, inching forward.
They looked like hairless monkeys, naked but for little red caps, and without any appreciable sex characteristics. They were as green as sin. Bach turned to say, "Look, Elfie, it's like you had a passel of babies." But he didn't see her, and remembered then that she hadn't come. Nor had Glinda, apparently. Damn. They danced. The crowd was the most mixed Bach had seen in some time. There were animals, humans, dwarfs, elves, and several TikTok things of incomplete or experimental gender. A squadron of well-built blonde boys circulated with tumblers of rot-gut squash wine, which the friends drank because it was free.
"I don't know if I want to go any more daring than this," said Fanet to Bach at one point. "I mean, look, that hussy of a baboon is almost out of her dress. Perhaps we should call it a night."
"Do you think?" said Bach. "I mean, I'm game, but if you're feeling uneasy—" Oh, hurrah, a way out. He was feeling uneasy himself. "Well, let's get Averick. He's over there nosing up to Shen Shen." But before they could make their way across the crowded dance floor, the elves began to let out a banshee screech, and the singer thrust out her hip and said,
"That's the mating call, dollies, ladies and gentle friends. We're doing, and I do mean doing."
She glanced at a note in her hand.
"Five black clubs, three black clubs, six red hearts, seven red diamonds, and on their honeymoon. Isn't it sweet?"
She simulated gagging.
two black spades. Up to the mouth of everlasting bliss, Fraides and Gentlehands.
Averick, no, said Bok.
But the crone from the front, who called herself Yackle, came knocking through the hall, having apparently locked up the front door for the time being, and she remembered the holders of the designated cards, and brought them forward with a smile. "All rides, all riders, on the ready," she said. "Here we be at the shank end of the evening. Lighten up, lads, it's not a funeral, it's an entertainment."
It had been a funeral, Bok remembered, trying to invoke the warm, self-effacing spirit of Amma Clutch. But the time to back out, if such a time existed, had passed. They were swept through the oak doors and along a slightly sloping passage whose walls were padded in red and blue velvet. A merry tune was playing farther on, a dancing, ragged melody. A smell of roasting tim leaves, sweet and softening. You could almost feel them turning up their purplish edges. Yackle led the way, and the 23 revelers processed in a confused state of apprehension, elation, and randiness. The dwarf followed behind. Bok took stock, as best his stumbling mind could manage. An erect tiger in hip boots and a cape. A couple of bankers and their evening consorts, all wearing black masks. As a protection against blackmail, or as an aphrodisiac. A party of merchants from Ev and Fleon, in town on business. A couple of women, rather long in the tooth, bedecked in costume jewelry. The honeymoon couple were Glickens. Bok hoped that his crowd wasn't gawping as much as the Glickens were. As he glanced around, only Averick and Shenshen looked eager. And Fiuro, possibly because he hadn't yet grasped what this was all about. The others looked more than a little squeamish. They entered a small, dark theater in the round, with the space for the public divided into six stalls. Above, the ceiling was lost in a stony blackness. Tapers fluttered, and a hollow music issued through fissures in the wall, increasing an unearthly air of dislocation and otherness. The stalls circled and faced the central stage, which was enshrouded in black drapes. The stalls were separated from one another by vertical strips of latticed wood and slats of mirror. All the parties were being mixed up, all friends and partners separated. Was there incense in the air, too? It seemed to make Bok's mind split in half, like a husk, and allow a tenderer, complacent mind to emerge. The softer, more bruisable aspect, the private intention, the surrendering self. He felt he was knowing less and less, and it was more and more beautiful to do so. Why had he been alarmed? He was sitting on a stool, and around him in the stall sat, almost preternaturally near, a man in a black mask, an asp he hadn't noticed before, the tiger whose breath ran hot and meaty on his neck, a beautiful schoolgirl, or was that the bride on her honeymoon? Did the whole stall then tilt forward like a gently swung bucket? Anyway, they leaned together toward the central dais, an altar of veils and sacrifices. Bok loosened his collar, and then his belt. Felt the gingery appetite between heart and stomach, and the resulting stiffening apparatus below that. The music of pipes and whistles was slowing, or was it that, as he watched and waited and breathed so slowly, that the secret area inside himself uncloaked itself, where nothing mattered? The dwarf, in a darker hood now, appeared on the stage. He could see from his vantage point into all the stalls,
but the revelers in separate stalls couldn't see one another. The dwarf leaned and reached a hand here, there, welcoming, beckoning. He encouraged from one stall the figure of a woman, from another a man. Was it Tibbet? And from the stall where Bok sat, he gestured to the tiger. Bok felt only faintly sorry not to be chosen himself, as he watched the dwarf pass a smoking vial beneath the nostrils of the three acolytes, and help them to remove their clothes. There were shackles, and a tray of scented oils and emollients, and a chest whose contents were still in shadow. The dwarf bound black blindfolds around the heads of the scholars. The tiger was pacing on all fours and growling softly, tossing his head back and forth in distress or excitement. Tibbet, for it was he, though nearly out of consciousness, was made to lie on his back on the floor of the stage. The tiger strode over him and stood still, while the dwarf and his assistants lifted Tibbet and tied his wrists together around the tiger's chest, and his ankles around the tiger's pelvis. So Tibbet hung beneath the tiger's belly like a trussed pig, his face lost in the tiger's chest hair. The woman was set on a sloping stool, almost like a huge tilting bowl, and the dwarf tucked something aromatic and runny up in the shadowy regions. Then the dwarf pointed to Tibbet, who was beginning to twist and moan into the tiger's chest.
"Let X be the unknown god," said the dwarf, poking Tibbet in the ribs.
The dwarf then slapped the tiger on his flank with a riding crop, and the tiger strained forward, positioning his head between the woman's legs.
"Let Y be the dragon of time in its cave," said the dwarf, hitting the tiger again.
As he laced the woman into the half-shell, stroking her nipples with a glowing salve, he handed her a riding crop with which she could lash at the tiger's flanks and face.
"And let Z be the Cumbric witch, and let us see if she exists tonight."
The crowd drew nearer, almost participants themselves, and the musky sense of adventure made them tear at their own buttons and nibble their own lips, leaning in, in, in.
"Such are the variables in our equation," said the dwarf, as the room darkened even further. "So now let the true clandestine study of knowledge begin."
The industrialists of Shiz, from an early stage wary of the growing power of the wizard, had elected not to lay down the rail line from Shiz to the Emerald City as originally planned. Therefore, it was a good 3 days' journey from Shiz to the Emerald City, and this was in the best of weather, for the wealthy who could pay for a constant change of horses. For Glinda and Elphaba, it took more than a week. A bleak, cold-scoured week, as the winds of autumn ripped the leaves off trees with a dry screech and a rattle of brittle, protesting limbs. They rested, like other third-class travelers, in the back rooms above inn kitchens. In a single lumpy bed, they huddled together for warmth and encouragement, and, Glinda told herself, protection. The ostlers cooed and shrieked in the stable-yard below. The kitchen-maids came and went noisily at odd hours. Glinda would start as if from a frightful dream, and nestle in nearer to Elphaba, who seemed at night never to sleep. Daytimes, the long hours spent in poorly sprung carriages, Elphaba would nod off against Glinda's shoulder. The land outside grew less succulent and varied. Trees were crabbed, as if conserving their strength. And then the sandy scrubland was domesticated by farm life. Overgrazed fields were dotted with cows, their withers shriveled and papery, their lowing desperate. An emptiness settled in the farmyards. Once Glinda saw a farm woman standing on her doorstep, hands sunk deep in apron pockets, face lined with grief and rage at the useless sky. The woman watched the carriage pass, and her face showed a yearning to be on it, to be dead, to be anywhere else other than on this carcass of a property. The farms gave way to deserted mills and abandoned granges. Then, abrupt and decisive, the Emerald City rose before them. A city of insistence, of blanket declaration. It made no sense, clotting up the horizon, sprouting like a mirage on the characterless plains of central Oz. Glinda hated it from the moment she saw it. Brash upstart of a city. She supposed it was her Gilliconese superiority asserting itself. She was glad of it. The carriage passed through one of the northern gates, and the scramble of life aroused itself again, but in an urban key, less restrained and self-forgiving than that of Shiz. The Emerald City was not amused by itself, nor did it consider amusement a proper attitude for a city. Its high self-regard sprang up in public spaces, ceremonial squares, parks and facades, and reflecting pools. How juvenile! How devoid of irony, murmured Glinda. The pomp, the pretension. But Elphaba, who had passed through the Emerald City only once before, on her way up to Shiz, had no interest in architecture. She had her eyes glued on the people. No animals, she said. Not so you can see, anyway. Maybe they have all gone underground. Underground? Said Glinda, thinking of legendary menaces like the Gnome King and his subterranean colony, or dwarves in their mines in Glickus, or the Time Dragon of the old myths dreaming the world of Oz from his airless tomb. In hiding, said Elphaba. Look, the poor. I mean, are they the poor? The hungry of Oz? From the failed farms? Or is it just the surplus? The expendable human selvage? Look at them, Glinda. This is a real question. The Quadlings, having nothing, looked more than these. Off the boulevard on which they rode branched alleys, where shelves of tin and cardboard served as roofs for the flood of indigents. Many of them were children, though some were the diminutive Munchkinlanders, and some were dwarves, and some were Gilliconese, bowed with hunger and strain. The carriage moved slowly, and faces stood out. A Glickan youth with no teeth and no feet or calves, on his stumpy knees in a box, begging. A Quadling. Look, a Quadling, said Elphaba, grabbing Glinda's wrist. Glinda caught a glimpse of a ruddy brown woman in a shawl, lifting a small apple to the child in a sling.